hello, and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College University Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 28th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're lucky today to have for the entire hour memoirist and novelist James Brown. James's acclaimed memoir, The Los Angeles Diaries, published by HarperCollins in 2003, is an intimate portrait of his dysfunctional family, covering his childhood, Hollywood script meetings, his splintered marriage, and his life with his older brother and sister. Publishers Weekly had wonderful things to say about The Los Angeles Diaries. It was named a best book of the year by them. And the San Francisco Chronicle and the Independent of London. He's also author of several novels, including Going Fast, Hot Wire, and Lucky Town. His personal essays have appeared in GQ, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times Magazine, and Plowshares. James's writing has also been featured in Denver Quarterly and New England Review. He's been anthologized in Best American Sports Writing of 2006, Fathers and Sons, and Sports, an anthology of great American sports writing published by ESPN in 2008. The River, published by Counterpoint in 2010, is a continuation of the Los Angeles Diaries, picking up where the first memoir ended, with many of the same themes of family, addiction, and recovery. He's also co-editor of Writers on the Edge, 22 Writers Speak About Addiction, just published by Modern History Press. James received the Nelson Algren Award for Short Fiction, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction Writing, and a Chesterfield Film Writing Fellowship from Universal Amblin Entertainment. He was a visiting fellow at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. He received his MFA from Where I Sit here at UC Irvine, and he now teaches in the MFA program at California State University San Bernardino. He lives with his family in Lake Arrowhead. And before we bring him on, I just wanted to read a blurb that Publishers Weekly, what they said about this book. Novelist Brown mines the explosive territory of his own harsh and complicated life in this gut-wrenching memoir. Brown flays open his own tortured skin, looking for what blood beats beneath and why. The result is a grimly exquisite memoir that reads like a noir novel, but grips unrelentingly like the hand of a homeless drunk begging for help. And James is going to be on my memoir panel in April, I think the 14th, in just a couple of weeks here at UCI at the Literary Orange Conference. You can find out more about that by Googling Literary Orange. And he'll also be a guest in May at the Pen on Fire Writers Salon, along with Claire Bidwell Smith. So let's bring him on. Hi, James.
Hi. How are you doing this morning?
Great to talk with you. So much to talk about here. But for those unfamiliar with your memoirs, will you talk about how these two came about?
Okay, good question. it was a long time coming with the Los Angeles Diaries. And I was 9 years between books, and during that time I had some personal setbacks with alcohol and narcotics, and I had to put my life back together, get clean and sober. At that point, there I started to write again, and the Los Angeles Diaries, I had no intentions of ever actually publishing the book. This book was written simply so I could get past what had happened in my life and be able to move forward.
So if you had no intention on publishing, I mean, I think that's probably a good thing, don't you, in terms of writing a memoir and just putting it all down?
I think it is a good thing. I mean, I had no expectations. I wasn't writing for publication. I wasn't concerned about it. It took some of the pressure off me.
At what point did you decide to publish?
And that's kind of a long story, too, but it involves another UCI graduate, Jervy Turvalon, who knew that I was in recovery. And I was very gun-shy at that point there. I had no confidence left anymore. My self-esteem was gone. All the things that alcohol and drugs take from you, they had taken from me. And it was Dervey that, you know, after a certain while, he knew I was writing again, and said, well, why don't you send your work in and try and get it published? And he said, I know a guy at the Los Angeles Times Magazine that might like your work. And so I called this fellow up on Dervey's urging, and I stuttered and I stammered, and the guy was brief with me and just said, oh, just send him in. And so I sent him two pieces, and about a week later, he called me back up and said, how much would you like for them? So that's how it started again.
And then how did that transition then to a book?
Well, the book was written in pieces. Actually, the ending was written first. And that was, you know, as you know with the book, the ending is where I begin my journey with recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point there, after I'd written that section, that I began to backtrack. And then I began with the first piece and worked my way forward.
Hmm. So are you saying South Dakota was the first piece?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. Don't usually begin with the last chapter, do you? Usually begin with the first.
Yeah. But then I suppose when you started writing the memoir, you knew where you were headed. And is that a good thing? I mean, do you think all memoirists should know where they're headed?
I think I discovered where I was headed in the process of writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began to see how the pieces were interconnected. And once I began to see that, I was able to strengthen those various connections. I decided that I was going to do a different sort of memoir in the sense that I didn't want to follow a linear path. I wanted to take the most defining moments from my life and the ones that shape you and your character and the person you are, and write about those and skip all the materials in between, the kind of connective tissue that sometimes, you know, it just doesn't add up to much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to actually talk to you about that because I think, well, I don't know if it's my favorite form, but I do love episodic memoirs. And it seems that whereas a novel needs to be, most novels need to be chronological or linear in terms of, you know, time-wise from start to finish, episodic memoirs work so well. What's your feeling, though, about structuring an episodic memoir? I mean, do you think it depends on the story the writer has to tell, or do you think that as long as the individual pieces connect from one to the next, it can work?
I think it's a little of both, frankly. Sometimes the material kind of defines itself and will lead you to a linear story. And other times, you know, as we imagine our life, memory is not sequential, and so sometimes we pick and choose what memories we want to focus on. But episodic memoir is a little more structurally, a little tougher sometimes to write, in the sense that you want it all to pull together as a whole, and you want a beginning, middle, and end, but not necessarily in that order. But you want a sense of completion so that when the reader finishes the book, they feel like they've read something whole.
Yeah. I mean, time in memoir is, although a memoir should be true, a memoir is still a construction, and you can't leave everything in, and maybe certain experiences or such need to be combined?
Yes. There's a lot of manipulation that goes into a memoir. There's a lot of stories that get left out simply because you need to focus on the story that you're attempting to tell the best way you can. And you can't let the material sprawl in such a way that you lose the focus. And so, yeah, you end up compressing time. You end up leaving out people that, you know, were part of your life, but may not have been such big players that they deserve the or merit their time on stage. So it's an art putting a memoir together. It's just not simply chronicling your past.
Mm-hmm. In terms of that too, I wonder about when your two books, The Los Angeles Diaries and The River, The Los Angeles Diaries actually seems to be more or have more of a narrative arc than the river. I mean, they both are episodic, but the river's a little bit more episodic, perhaps. Do you find that?
I think you're right, yes. The L.A. Diary has a lot of more overlapping material, and there are, I make allusions in certain sections that arouse the interest of the reader. Maybe, you know, for instance, mentioning the unfortunate death of little baby Catherine, and mentioning that in the opening section, knowing that the reader is going to wonder, well, who is this baby, and what's this all about? And then playing on that a little bit later in an appropriate episode when it falls more naturally or becomes more organic to the material. And so you have, and it's the same with the suicide of my brother, introducing him when he's alive and then going back to a time when he's passed on. And when I began to see this overlapping materials, I was able to start to link them together in a fashion that I felt compelled the reader.
Yeah, so again, we're back to the art of the memoir, which is not a straight autobiography. It's not an autobiography at all, really. I mean, people sometimes, I think, get confused on what or how autobiography differs, you know, from memoir.
Right.
This would be a wonderful time to hear you read from the Los Angeles Diaries. Would you do that?
Sure, I'd be glad to.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with James Brown, and his memoirs are The Los Angeles Diaries and The River. This River.
Is there a section from The Los Angeles Diaries?
Oh, gosh. I wonder about... Well, I don't want to give away the end, the last. So maybe just start at the beginning.
Start at the beginning? Okay, let me see.
I love how you scene set, and we're going to talk a bit about that, too.
Okay. This is from this Los Angeles Diaries. And it's the opening section. It's dated winter of 1994. The title is called Fire. Winter is the season of the arsonist in Southern California. The manzanita and chaparral are dry and brittle, and the Santa Ana winds have begun to blow. They move at gale force. They cross the arid Mojave and whip through the canyons of the San Bernardino Mountains. The live oak and the pines, the ponderosa, the sugar and coulter, white fir and incense cedar. I know these names because I live in these mountains, 80 miles east of the sprawl of Los Angeles. And I worry about the wind. I worry when the winds come. I worry about the possibility of fire. I know he's out there, the arsonist. I know he's waiting, like me, for a day of opportunity, very much like this. I've seen the Santa Ana's uproot trees. I've seen them strip roofing from houses and shatter windows. I've seen them topple big rigs. And once, along the same freeway I'm traveling now, I saw a stop sign flying through the sky. I keep a firm hold on the wheel. The winds hit in sharp gusts and can blow you clean over the line. You have to be ready. You have to hang on tight and keep your eyes on the road. Traffic moves slowly, carefully. No one's taking any chances, making abrupt lane changes, cutting you off, or tailgating. I would like to believe that it's courtesy that dictates our caution, our good manners. Except this is Southern California. I grew up here, and I know better. Danger, or its potential, sometimes brings out the best in us. And I wonder, as I reach a turn on the radio, if maybe it would be a good thing if the Santa Ana's blew every day, all year round.
Thank you. That's lovely. Talk about that. Talk about scene setting and its place in memoir, because you do that throughout your books. And I mean, I think the best novels, the best memoirs, the best of everything does scene setting, and maybe more than the writer thinks is even necessary. Would you talk a little bit about that?
When I teach, I talk a lot about sense of place. And for me, it's a big deal when I write. In the Los Angeles Diaries, I see Los Angeles pretty much as a character in the story. And I try and tell my students that they ought to imagine similarly, that when they set a story, that the setting has some reflection on the thematic of the book, in this case here, Los Angeles comes in and out of the narrative and has much to do with, you know, shaping, you know, the lives that occupy this book. And so setting, sense of place to me is a very, very big deal.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, it like you said, it's almost another character, and one that we get to know and want to stay with, actually. I want to go back to what you said earlier about when you wrote the book, you really didn't intend to publish it. You wrote it really for yourself and where you were at and your journey and coming clean and just everything you'd been through. Did you later worry at all about when you knew you were going to publish, did you worry at all about offending anybody or offending anybody's memory or what people might say once they read it? Or how did you deal with that aspect of publishing?
That's a good question. That's a question that every memoirist has to wrestle with. I think you have to know going in that whatever you write, whenever you're writing about your life, and your life is inextricably linked to the lives of others, nonetheless, you're not going to please people the people that you've written about, you're not going to please them. It wouldn't even matter if you wrote them as heroes. They're going to find deficiencies in the work or differences in the work. And once had was asked a question about, would it be best, this was another memoirist, and asked me a question about what they should do. And they said, well, should I talk with the people that I'm writing about to see if I have the story straight? And I told that person, no, you ought not to. You ought to stick with your version of the truth. If you start to consult other people on the same event, I think you and I both know, Barbara, that you get three or four different interpretations for the same event that everybody witnessed. And so you got to stick to your own emotional core, your own emotional truth. And there are consequences for writing Los Angeles diaries. My niece no longer speaks to me. My brother-in-law no longer speaks to me. So there are consequences when you write about your own life. But you can't write about your own life without writing about the lives of others.
Were you surprised that they reacted that way? Or did you expect it?
I didn't expect it from my niece so much as I did from my brother-in-law, but that's the way it happens. And obviously because that's his daughter, she would side with her father.
What about allowing people to vet the manuscript before, perhaps after you've submitted it to an agent, and the agent wants to sell it, or even after the editor has seen it? I mean, at any point along the way, do you think you should allow people to read it to maybe get, I don't know, dates right? Or, I mean, what about, you know, that aspect of the memoir? If a memoir needs to be true and not so that you're not accused of fictionalizing later on, what about, you know, dates or you know, place names or things, you know, factual.
Right, actual facts.
Yeah.
I think that there's an emotional truth that the memoirist goes after. Let me tell you, if I can make this anecdote short, I tend to talk a long time and get carried away.
Oh, go ahead. Get carried away. It's all right.
Okay. when I was in first grade, my mother was incarcerated, and I was having emotional problems. I was labeled emotionally disturbed. I think I'm still emotionally disturbed, but in any event, I had this teacher, and she had, and I was only 6 years old, but she really had nice legs. She was a very pretty teacher, and I would stare at her all the time, and between staring at my teacher and looking out the window and daydreaming, I ultimately failed the class. Everybody at the end of the day, you know, when class let out for the last day, everybody got a report card except me, and I got a letter from, I just got a letter addressed to my father, that was the last thing I wanted to bring home to my father. He was going through enough turmoil and enough stress, and even though I was only six, I knew I didn't want to add any more stress and trouble to the household by my failure at school. So instead of going home, I sat in the bushes outside the school, and along came this fellow, a guy named Jerry, which is his real name, and Jerry was a state wrestling champ. I lived in a tough neighborhood, and he was a tough guy, and I really looked up to him like most of the kids in the neighborhood looked up to him. And he said, you know, he drove by and he spotted me in the bushes. Jimmy, what are you doing in the bushes? And I, you know, I came out of the bushes. He says, come on, let me give you a ride back home. And he put me on the handlebars of his bicycle, and gave me a ride back home. But as we were driving to the neighborhood, it was, I was a king. There I was with Jerry, and everybody could see me, that I was one of Jerry's friends. And everything, for a moment, was okay. Now, in that story, I tell, I could say that the day was unseasonably cold for June in San Jose, which is used to be a farming community.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets very warm in June. And I could say that, the teacher's dress was yellow instead of blue. And those particular details, you could go to the almanac, at least for the weather, and find out what the day was, weather was on that particular day. But I don't think that would matter so much. I think I could lie about that. I think I could slip that one under. The color of her dress, I don't think that anybody really truly cares whether it was yellow, blue, or red. But what I can't lie about is that I failed first grade. And what I can't lie about is that I had a crush on my teacher. And what I can't lie about is that Jerry picked me up. So in memoir, there's a certain level, a gauge, a measurement of accuracy that I go by. The smaller details of memory, the ones those facts you're talking about, to me are not nearly as important as what I would consider getting at the emotional core truth of the book. One of the people did not do the memoir any favors, James Fry. I'm sure you remember the controversy there.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did is he fibbed on major events about his character and his person. And that's where I think you got to draw the line. Memoir has to be true to all the major and significant events in your life. It may not necessarily have to be true to the smaller details of weather, color of a dress, those kinds of details. Sometimes an author has to make them up. Frankly, we have a conversation that occurred 40 years ago or 30 years ago. Very few of us, unless we have a photographic memory, could remember that conversation verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to recreate it. If we're going to recreate a scene, and we're going to have to make some of it up. But we cannot deviate from the core. If we deviate from the core, then we might as well be writing a novel.
Yeah, exactly. Or, if you have to make up dialogue, then, and you didn't take notes as to what someone said, then what would they have said?
Well, that's it. You've got to do to the best of your ability. Remember the emotional impact the encounter had on you, and then try to reconstruct it in such a way as to make the reader feel as you felt at the time that event occurred.
Yeah. This has been great, and I'm so glad we have you for the entire hour, because we're going to take a short break right now, and when we return, we will be back with more James Brown, and I hope you all stay with us out there. He's going to read again, and we have more to say about writing and so much else. So please stay with us.
Come back, baby, don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
I lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I've been here with James Brown for the first half, and I'm back with him again. He is the author of novels, novella, and the two memoirs, The Los Angeles Diaries and This River. And he's also co-editor of Writers on the Edge, 22 Writers Speak Out About Addiction and Dependency, published by Modern Press, Modern History Press. Let's bring him back on. Hi, James.
Hi.
You started out as a fiction writer. Talk about moving to memoir and what the crossover may have been, if there was any.
As you said, I started off as a novelist and short story writer, and the techniques that I learned in crafting and shaping a scene, and you were talking about earlier about generating, creating a sense of place. All the tools that go into being a good fiction writer, I think, go into being a good memoirist. And we use all of those things at our disposal. And I think that's what's happened with the modern memoir that separates it from the autobiography that you were talking about earlier as well, where it's not simply a narrative of our life, but in memoir, we have the opportunity to attempt to use fictional techniques to recreate our lives and reinvent in some regards.
Mm-hmm. When you're teaching, do you, because I get this question a lot from new writers, should I start with short stories so that I learn how to write fiction, or can I go right into a novel? What do you say to students who ask you that?
I've changed over the years. I used to think that the breeding ground, the beginning place, the ground zero was to learn how to write a good short story, and then graduate into the novel. Now, I think that that's where most beginning writers begin, is with the short story. But I think at a certain point, you're going to discover, a person is likely to discover that maybe they're not a short story writer. Maybe their work needs to sprawl, to branch out. Maybe they're not built to try and contain and compress their work. Maybe we should encourage people that want to do the marathon to run a marathon rather than a sprint. And so I think some of us, unless you're truly a committed short story writer and that's your form, then that's where you should stay. But if you feel a little frustrated with the short story, that you can't tell the story you want to tell and you keep trying to cut and compress to make it all fit, well, maybe you should tell yourself, I need to relax and sprawl and let this book and let this thing become what it might want to be, which might be a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. And likewise, there are a few short story writers, famous actually short story writers, that were encouraged by editors, agents, publishers, whomever, to write the novel, and the novels just, sink.
Yes.
They should stick with the short story.
Right, right.
It's interesting. It's interesting how, instructors can blend, start with a short story to learn how to write, when in fact that may not be you.
Exactly. And I felt frustrated at a certain point and began that novel you mentioned, Going Fast, in the very beginning of the program. Very few people even know about that book. And I would think I was 19 when I wrote that. And I was frustrated as a short story writer, and I needed to branch out. And so I was a novelist from the beginning, I think, although I did win the Nelson Algren Award in short fiction. So I can write a short story, but I think that I'm a novelist or a memoirist. I think I'm a long-distance runner.
Mm-hmm. Now, when were you here at the in the MFA program?
Shoot, we're going back. I was there when Oakley Hall, which he succeeded, I think, James Hall. Or is it James Hall?
Hmm.
Oakley was one of the earlier instructors in the UCI writing program, and I studied under Oakley Hall and a fellow named Don Heine, who wrote under the pen name McDonald Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the opportunity for the visiting writer to learn from Tom Keneally.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so I was back, I want to say 80-something, but I'm not sure. I think it's 85 or 86 or so.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like in the 80s and even the early 90s, MFA programs were more rare and not everybody went into them. Now, it seems that a lot of writers feel that they have to get an MFA to get published. How do you feel about that? Because you teach you teach writing, and so maybe an unfair question even to ask you, but what do you feel about that? I mean, do you feel like MFAs are necessary? Do you think they're only necessary for certain types of writers that perhaps don't have a writing community around them? What do you think?
Mixed feelings on that. I don't think you have to have an MFA to write a good book. I think that it depends. Now, if you have good instructors, veteran writers who've gone the distance a couple of times over and have written a novel and have made their mistakes and have learned from their mistakes, that sometimes they can bring to the table, the classroom, a certain knowledge that might be helpful to their students in getting them on the right path quicker. But now that isn't necessarily so, because just because you're a good writer doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a good teacher. They're different crafts, actually. And so it really depends on the MFA program, and it really depends on the commitment of the instructor, the open-mindedness of the student. And I do believe that there is a kind of a homogenous kind of safe writing that comes out of workshops where during the workshop process that so many of the students, you know, they get criticized, and so their next version of their story, they've been criticized. So they want to avoid the criticism, so they start writing cautiously, mm-hmm. and so they get acceptance. And there's a danger in that, because that's stifling a certain level of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got its pluses and it's got its minuses, but I don't believe you have to go to an MFA to write an MFA program to learn how to write a good novel. You got to do a lot of reading, and you got to look at your, when you read, you got to study the books and see how they're structured. And so many of us, before we enter into academia, we used to read to enjoy, we enjoyed reading. and now, it's because we've become very conscious of the craft, when we look at work sometimes, we're not looking to enjoy it anymore. We're just looking for holes in it. We're looking for how it's structured. We're looking, just, we've been trained. Our critical capacity has been sharpened to such a degree that the enjoyment that we once took from writing is, sometimes it's lost.
Mm-hmm. That's funny because, my 17-year-old and I have been watching, classic movies since he could sit up, probably, you know, starting with Hitchcock and a lot of the noir movies and, you know, the classics. And the other day he said to me, he said, you know, it's not as fun watching movies anymore because I'm looking at the structure. I thought that was really funny. It's like, yeah, you know, once you start studying structure, I mean, it's fun in a different way, but you're not just being entertained anymore.
Right, right. But at that same, on the other hand, you become a better reader or a better viewer.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at some of those old classic movies, I think to myself, I'm entering into a time now where they're not going to have fast cuts.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be shifting scenes every 5 seconds, and they're not going to have these huge special effects. Actually, they're most likely going to have a drama play out. There's going to be a much more exchange, a greater exchange in dialogue. It's going to be similar to a play, because that was where, you know, that's where it started with the plays, and then from the plays it went to the, you know, old black and white movies. But those were character driven and oftentimes, you know, character driven stories.
Mm-hmm. So true. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I've been here with James Brown, who is a memoirist and novelist, and he will be at Literary Orange April 14th with me and Matt Logelin, I believe, on a memoir panel. And Literary Orange, you can Google that to find out more. And then on May 15th, he will be at the Pen on Fire Writers Salon. And if you go to my website, penonfire.com, and click on Writers Salon, you will find out details and how to register and on and on. Back to your memoirs. In the beginning of each, you have a disclaimer. Although this work contains descriptions of people in my life, many of their names and other identifying characteristics have been changed to protect their privacy. Talk about that. Did you change names and such before you submitted this, or were these put in later by the publisher who said, you know what, I think you better just do this and this, and we're going to put a disclaimer in there so no one thinks you're fictionalizing?
I did change names, except when I was dealing with my brother and my sister and my mother and father. There's no point in changing the names in cases like that. They're easily identifiable, but smaller people are not. I don't mean smaller in the negative sense, but I mean the surrounding cast. Those names had to be changed. Identifying characteristics had to be changed. That's a legal disclaimer that the publisher requires. And I remember the lawyers going over the lawyers when this book was originally published with HarperCollins. It's since been republished. Los Angeles Diaries with Counterpoint Press, and so has This River. It's new with Counterpoint, and I just heard yesterday that the Los Angeles Diaries is going into another printing, and the novelist, screenwriter, and memoirist, Jerry Stahl, has been kind enough to write just a wonderful, wonderful foreword to the Los Angeles Diaries. So that should, the reprint should be out in a couple of weeks. Now I forgot what the question was.
Oh, about the disclaimer.
The disclaimer,
yeah.
Okay, that brings me back to HarperCollins, and the lawyers there are pretty strict about it. They wanted everything changed because in a court of law, what they need to do in the event that you might get sued, is they need to be able to stand before a jury and say the author had every good intention to alter the identifying characteristics of the person. So he made a good faith or she made a good faith effort to protect this person's identity. And that's what the lawyer said the bottom line was. I need that defense.
Mm-hmm. So would that include, characteristics like job and coloring and heritage and all that sort of thing? Or might it just be limited to name?
Not just name, no. Hair color, physical descriptions. You need to make more than just a name change.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about titles? What do you have to say about titles? Because titles are one of those, it's not elusive so much as just, how important a title is for gaining an agent or editor's interest and a reader's. And yet, do we obsess too much over finding the right title?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've given a lot of thought, but I'm terrible with titles. The Los Angeles Diaries just came. That was what I imagined it as. The name came early. This River, however, was originally titled "Instructions on the Use of Heroin," which my agent and editor thought, "Well, that's great, Jim. That book is going to sell 50 copies." And he also, my editor, Dan Semantenka, is a wonderful man. You're going to meet him at Literary Orange, too. I believe he'll be there moderating one of the fiction panels.
Mm-hmm.
He was responsible for he said your book is really orbits around, when we're talking about this river, orbits around the centerpiece, or what he considered the centerpiece essay or chapter entitled This River. And so he made me go back and revisit that particular piece and revise it and revise it and revise it. And it eventually became, like I said before, the centerpiece of the book. A title, I think, should be organic to the material. It shouldn't be an extrapolation, an abstract extrapolation of the book. I think it should be literal, and then if it has meaning, that meaning ought to resonate from the material itself. An example I oftentimes use is Moby Dick. That book could have been titled a million different names, but Melville felt, that Moby Dick was the appropriate title to put on that book, and it's very simple, but that book is anything but simple.
Mm-hmm. And I've also heard authors talk about how the fewer words in a title, the better. What do you think about that?
I haven't thought about that, but there's some people that break the rules on that one. Michael Chabon.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it the title of his last book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay?
Uh-huh.
A little bit long. Mysteries of Pittsburgh, I guess that's not too long. Now, some writers break the rules on that. I don't know if there's any hard and fast rules on that. I remember Michael Chabon. We were in the same class together, by the way, at UCI. And he had said, when I was titling one of my books, one of my novels called Final Performance, I remember his criticism was, he goes, this sounds too much like a novel title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course I was very stubborn and said, well, yes, of course it sounds like a novel title. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
What he was basically saying, though, is be creative with the title, too.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, most memoirs have subtitles, and yours simply say a memoir.
Right.
Had you considered subtitles, or why did you not use one?
I never really gave it any thought. to tell you the truth, you kind of stumped me on that question.
Okay. Well, that's good enough. I mean, I like subtitles sometimes, and other times I don't feel that I need them. And I don't think I felt that I needed a subtitle with your books. I didn't know what I was going into when I started reading them, but these titles are nice.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Will you read from this river?
Sure, I'd be glad to. any particular section?
Well, you know, I would love to hear the beginning of maybe the first couple of pages of Some Kind of Animal that starts on 89.
Okay.
In my copy.
Okay, let me grab it here.
And you're listening to Writers on Writing, and we have just a few minutes left with James Brown, author of This River and the Los Angeles Diaries.
Okay, the title of the piece is Some Kind of Animal, and it's taken from This River by Counterpoint Press. Some Kind of Animal. My obsession with muscle comes to an abrupt and sudden end along a narrow two-lane mountain highway in the San Bernardino Mountains. Elevation, 5,500 feet, dead of winter. Here I am far removed from the cities and suburban sprawl to lowlands of Southern California. The night before, it snowed lightly, and the limbs of the pines bordering the highway are white with frost. It's a beautiful sight, how the branches shimmer in the morning sun. The roads are treacherous, slick with black ice, the most dangerous kind because it blends into the asphalt, a shining, fine veneer. You can barely see it, if you can see it at all. In years past, I've spun out on it. And now they wrecked my car, so I've learned to drive carefully. I'm making slow but safe progress when a Dodge Ram suddenly appears in my rearview mirror. I ignore it. Soon, I look for a place to turn out, let him by, but there is none. As we continue down the highway, he edges closer and closer to my bumper until his big front grille fills my back window. My heart begins to pound, and I ease up on the accelerator. That's when he flips on his high beams and two sets of fog lamps. Together, they are blinding. My face feels hot. My ears ring, and then, without further warning, I snap. When he lays on his horn, I pull the wheel hard to the left so that the car spins sideways, locking both lanes and trapping him. Now I have the son of a bitch, and I don't care how big he is. I don't care if he's a tough guy or a coward. I jump out of my car. I want blood.
I love that beginning, and I love that piece too. And I, after I read it, I was thinking that, or what came to me was that one of the things I really enjoy about your work is that, and probably about all good memoirs, really, is the ability to be honest and to not have to portray yourself as a hero. You know, to be able to talk about weaknesses and shortcomings and yet remain a narrator we care about. As a writer, as you know, as a memoirist, what is your experience of being honest or trying to walk that line between, you know, being who you are and yet keeping that aspect of, I don't know, empathy going?
excuse me, I coughed this morning. I think you're right. I think you've kind of answered the question there, is that if you're going to be, if I can use the word good memoirist, I think you have to be honest and to the best of your ability show all the sides or facets of your character, both the good and the not so good. And if you're doing anything short of that, then you're not coming clean, because very few of us are perfect, and I'm far from it. And I also think, too, that when we're honest and we show our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses, our shortcomings, that, guess what, other people are going to identify with that, because they have weaknesses, shortcomings, and vulnerabilities. And they're going to identify with some of those things that we might initially fear exposing about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, otherwise, if you're not able to do that, then don't write a memoir. Write fiction. Write
exactly.
You know, allow yourself to be private and because if you open yourself up and want to write a memoir, you're going to have to really go into all of it.
I think so.
Yeah. Real quick, and we have so much more to talk about regarding memoir, and I think we're going to just have to keep it for the Literary Orange panel and for the when you're down here at the Pen on Fire Writers Salon. Writers on the Edge, say a few words about this collection.
That's a collection that Diana Rabb and I, and Diana Rabb has written several novels herself and a memoir and some nonfiction books, very gracious woman. she approached me with the idea of putting together a book on addiction. She knew I was a recovering alcoholic and addict, and she had read my work, and she had invited me out to a writer's conference in Santa Barbara. We had a chance to meet, and it clicked. And so when she came up with this idea about putting together an anthology of writers writing about addiction and dependence of all sorts, whether it's from eating disorders to sex, to love, to whatnot, that addiction crosses a spectrum beyond drugs and alcohol. And, I said, sure, let's get together and do it. And it was a long process. And she I think she carried more weight than I did. But we both did a lot of reading, and we both did a lot of editing, and put together, I think, quite a good book with some very good writers in there. Scott Russell Sanders is one of them.
Yeah, I really enjoy this book. I so far have read pieces by Victoria Patterson and
yes,
Maud Casey and yours, of course, at the end. And I think it's wonderful. And
well, thank you.
So much more to talk to you about. So I'm glad we have a couple of more occasions to chat about your work. And
me too.
Any last words or advice for the writers listening?
Right from the heart. Put in the hours. That's what's going to make the difference. Set a schedule for yourself, put in those hours, and make your mistakes, and the only way you're going to find out about making those mistakes is making them, and you can't get there unless you put in the time to find them, and that's when you can find the path you're on. It's going to be a path of discovery, and it's going to mean, just to simplify, put in the hours.
That's right. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book, Outliers or something else. Maybe it's another title about how his study of notable people all put in something like 10,000 hours to achieve their greatness.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time.
It takes a lot of time. I think it's more hard work than it is talent. It really is.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks.
Okay, that sounds good. I really appreciate you taking the time to interview me.
You're quite welcome.
Okay.
That was James Brown. His memoirs are This River and The Los Angeles Diaries, so check them out, and do try to come to Literary Orange. Our panel's around 11:30 on a Saturday morning, or the Pen on Fire Writer Salon, where he'll be with Claire Bidwell Smith, who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. And you can find her show, podcast at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. That's all for today. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9 in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'll see you next time.